Winter travel for hunting, fishing, doing business, and engaging in social activities has been a big part of life in rural Alaska for generations. It takes cold weather to make ice for safe travel on rivers and the sea, and snow is crucial for travel across the tundra. Alaska's climate is changing, and getting out during winter for subsistence is more challenging than in the past. How are rural Alaskans adjusting? Wintertime food security is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Thanks for joining us this morning. Lots of Alaskans simply go to the grocery store when they need food. And of course, you can do that in many rural Alaska communities too, but the big expense makes it hard to stretch cash. When you're paying $9 or $10 or perhaps even more for a gallon of heating fuel or gasoline in some locations, it's even harder. Rural Alaskans rely on subsistence hunting and fishing, and warm winters make that tough. How are Alaskans in remote places adapting to changing climate conditions? Here to discuss that are my guests. Cyrus Harris is with Manilik's Traditional Foods Program in Kotzebue. Hi, Cyrus.
Good morning, Lori.
Thanks so much for being with us. Also in Kotzebue is Jim Dow. Jim is a caribou biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Lori.
All right. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us from Kotzebue. And in the studio with me is Carolina Behe. Hi, Carolina.
Good morning.
Carolina is the Indigenous Knowledge and Science Advisor with the Inuit Circumpolar Council, or ICC Alaska. Welcome to all of you. Before we launch into a discussion on hunting conditions and climate change, I want to first get an update from Jim Dow regarding a fire at his house last night. Jim, you're with us, and that's great, but how is your home?
Well, the home itself is probably a loss. I'm not sure, but the good news is the downstairs where we live, 99% of the contents are fine. The structure is still standing. It's keeping the wind and snow out. The upstairs was pretty much where the fire occurred, and it's pretty much a loss. So I was in there yesterday, and the woman that lived upstairs, her clothes and things are fine, but the things out in the front room, pretty tough.
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm so glad to hear that you and your family and everybody's okay. So that's the good news in a not good situation.
Absolutely. That's for sure. It could have been a lot worse. And it's just been absolutely remarkable, the outpouring of support from people here in Kotzebue, but statewide. It's also remarkable what a small state we are in terms of people and how people pull together. And I bet we'll hear about that today from the calls from the villages with regard to food security. But with our current situation here with this house fiasco, it's just been absolutely remarkable and humbling, the number of people that have contacted us offering socks and clean underwear and a place to live and food and everything else. It's just really amazing.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, and it doesn't surprise me at all. Alaskans are amazing in that respect and definitely pull together. So let's move on to our discussion about food security and changing climate. You can join us if you'd like. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. Or in the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Cyrus, I'd like to start with you because the idea for this discussion was born out of comments I heard from a former Kotzebue resident about the difficulty that hunters had last year because of the mild conditions, the mild winter. This year should be similar. In fact, we're getting a warm spell right now in South Central, and it sounds like in Kotzebue you're having similar conditions. What's the Kotzebue weather conditions today, Cyrus?
Well, the temperature today, for this past couple of days, we've been having a storm which was actually supposed to be dying down this afternoon, but it extended up until tonight. But the temperatures are definitely going to warm up. They're predicting a little bit of rain. We're kind of hoping that don't happen. That would really mess things back up again. But, it's the climate change that we're dealing with, and I'm seeing more constant east winds and so forth.
Well, tell us about what your work is in the traditional food program and how that was impacted during last winter.
Okay, well, from year to year, it seems to change. And a little bit about my work history. This program that I work for, the Hunter Support Program, it's designed to keep traditional foods on the elders' table. Excuse me. And all the villages within the Manilik service area are involved with this program, and I work directly with the tribes. This is how it actually works through the Hunter Support Program.
Well, tell us about that. Tell us about what that means, the Hunter Support Program. How do you help get food for elders for winter?
Well, it's designed for able-bodied hunters, fishermen that's supplied with a boat and a snow machine or whatnot, hunting equipment, you know, once the Hunter Support Program, when I say Hunter Support Program, it actually means gasoline, motor oil, and ammunition. And this program was designed quite early when I first started back in 93. It actually started out as a federal-funded program, you know, which is the nutritious program for the elderly. Back in the lower 48, we see that they served at the kitchens or at cafeterias or gather elders to feed or meals on wheels. But up this way, when the Title VI funds were introduced up this way, we couldn't go to the market to go buy the Western diet for our elders, mainly because they were not accustomed to it. So this is where the Hunter Support Program kicked in to switch, other than going to the market, to switch over to the purchasing gasoline, motor oil, and ammunition for able-bodied hunters, fishermen, gatherers to go out and harvest, you know, for the elders in need here. Mm-hmm. But it switched from the federal program to the state program, but for the past 15 years, it's been a board-generated fund that's been going up, that's been happening with Manila here, and my hat's off to the Manila Board of Directors.
So, beyond last winter, you mentioned that you notice more easterly winds. Talk a little about your observations about how the winter conditions are changing. This program's been in place since 1993. What what are you observing about the changing climate conditions and the changes in the winds?
Well, what I'm observing here is, like I mentioned earlier, more constant easterly winds. Like, for instance, when I was growing up, you know, west wind was like the norm. It was a cold wind, but, you know, things definitely freeze. But I don't recall seeing any west winds as of yet or for a while. We just don't see them. But and freeze up normally cool. It starts cooling off on the regular cycle, but then, of course, after we get some icing, then things turn around. We get east wind and southeast wind, and it changes to where, you know, it thaws back out. Last year, we had some boats that were put away because of freezing, and, of course, a week later, they were going back out in the waters. Hmm. So, that particular part I've seen.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about food security in a warming climate in Alaska. You can join our conversation, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or locally, 550-8422, 550-8422. Email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Cyrus, what are elders saying? How has this affected the ability to sort of read the weather conditions before people strike out to travel or hunt? Is it more difficult now to figure out what's going to be going on?
Well, I could speak back from when I was growing up. You see, I was raised out in the country, and with modern day technology, things changed. Back in the old day, we used to have one of our elderly folks, you know, observe the ice conditions when it's freezing. Where's the safest crossing going to be on some certain sloughs or rivers or lagoons? But they observe that every day, and then just as soon as it gets thick enough to walk across, for instance, Bob Ewell, he was just so happened to be one of the latest ones that did mark a little crossing, you know, toward his camp. And of course, we also using that crossing for like caribou hunting. But once he set the trail, then, you know, we use that up until, you know, it for that particular time of being. But today it seems to be different with snow machines and that's just going out and about and not really observing or marking a trail. So it would back in the old days when I was growing up, and I end up in a situation to where I feel like I, you know, need to make a right turn or a left turn, and I see a trail, I'll automatically get on that trail. Today it's different. We don't know if that snow machine trail is going 100 miles an hour or observing the trail and going 15, 20 miles. So looking out ahead of yourself and kind of observing the ice conditions before crossing.
Mm-hmm. I can see why that's increasingly important, both because of a changing climate and also, as you mentioned, going much faster on snow machines than people were traveling in years past. Jim Dow, you've been doing work for Alaska Fish and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. You're a caribou biologist. You've been doing this work in Kotzebue for 27 years. Talk about your observations, kind of capitalize on what Cyrus has been saying here, and tell us about your observations related to climate change in the Arctic.
Well, I certainly agree with Cyrus that, you know, things are warmer now than they were when we got here back in the late 80s. It used to be that the lakes and even the big rivers would be frozen, you know, sometime first week of October, and it was, you know, safe to travel on these shortly thereafter. But gosh, now we're into November, and there's lots and lots of places right now. I just flew a couple days ago that have lots of open water, and 15, 20 years ago that wouldn't have been the case. It seems like what I've seen, it's not been a steady progression, though, of colder to warmer. It's I can remember the years back, 2002, 2003, 2004, right around in there, that we had several years where there were not just dozens, but literally hundreds of examples of thermal erosion up in northwestern Alaska. And I fly for the department. I'm flying surveys, and so I range from the North Slope, Unit 26A, about as far as Point Lay, all the way down to Unalakleet, but as far east as, you know, the headwaters of the Noatak and Kobuk Rivers. And in those few years, there were just multitudes of big tundra slumps. It looked like somebody had rolled up the tundra, and what it was permafrost melting beneath the tundra, letting go, and the tundra was sliding down these really shallow grades. At the bottom, it looked like an accordion. It was the tundra all rolled up, and there was this big, gray, greasy slick above it. This happened inland. It happened on the coast. Some of these things shot out, 100 yards, 100 meters into the ocean. There were lots and lots of tundra lakes that just catastrophically drained. And I think that was somebody pulled the plug, you know, the permafrost plug below it, or the margin of the lake thawed. You could see when that happened, the water would run out. And a big lake could drain in a week or 10 days. Lots and lots of those things. On the rivers, there's a huge big slump, tundra slump, on the upper Selwood drainage. And there's another one forming, as you know, right now on the Willick River. Those things dump lots and lots of sediment into the river, so it's more than just a, you know, a barrier to fish right there. It's all the sedimentation coasting down the river afterwards. So the main thing I wanted to say is for 3 years, those things were rampant. And then I didn't see as many. And now when I fly over these places, it's equally amazing that a lot of them you can't even pick out. You can pick out the drained lakes, but the other things have revegetated. So not a smooth, steady progression from cold to warm, at least from what I've seen.
Well, I know a scientist that I've talked to calls it global weirding, not global warming, because and I've always thought that was an accurate way of describing what's happening, because there's a lot of change, and it's not an even warming everywhere, although we know that the planet overall is definitely warming. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're talking today about subsistence and food security in a warming and changing climate condition. Have you had to adjust how you travel or hunt in the winter because of climate change? How have you adapted? Does it make your subsistence work more expensive, more dangerous? Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. Carolina, I wanted to get you in on the conversation now. You've been patiently waiting here. Food security can have a different meaning depending on where you live and what your cultural norm is. Tell us about how ICC Alaska defines what food security is.
Sure. Well, I have to say it wasn't actually ICC Alaska. There is 145 Inuit across the four regions here in Alaska. That's Inupiat, St. Lawrence Island, Yupik, Central Yupik, and Chupik, that came up with a definition over the last couple of years for food security. I think the really key thing here is understanding that the Inuit culture is part of the ecosystem. So there's approximately 800 definitions for food security, and I only found two written by Indigenous peoples. And most of them are coming to the same understanding of the components that are most necessary to pay attention to. And those have a lot to do with purchasing power, caloric intake, nutrition. Those things are extremely important, of course, for Inuit food, but they're not the only things. When we're talking about food security, we're also talking about our languages, sharing systems, processing the food. All of these things are important parts of it. And I think the best analogy that was ever explained to me was when an elder described the Arctic to me as a puzzle. And he said that there's all these different pieces in the Arctic. And when those pieces are together, you can see food security, because you can see the entire Arctic in a healthy situation. And everything's always changing, so they're always adjusting to each other. But he said, and scientists often can understand that by seeing those pieces of the puzzle as systems. So we can say a piece of that puzzle is language, or a piece of that puzzle is culture. Those things are just as important to look at and understand the interlinking as much as it is to understand the interlinking between caribou and lichen, or ice and caribou. We have to be able to look at all of these things and how they interconnect. And I'm sure you've heard oftentimes of Inuit saying the need to look at things holistically, and that's exactly what we're talking about. So this need to look at things through a food security lens.
Mm-hmm. So, excuse me, tell us about the work of the Inuit Circumpolar Council's Food Security Advisory Committee. Who took part and what were the tasks?
So this project came from the board. Maybe I should start with who ICC is. So ICC represents 160,000 Inuit across Chukotka, Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. But each country has its own office also. So our country has a board that's made up of the membership organizations. Manilik is one of the membership organizations. That board confirmed that food security is the top priority in Alaska. And with the understanding that people were talking about two different things, they decided this project needed to be developed. So that board, our board nominated people to be part of an advisory committee. That advisory committee worked with us and the 95 tribal councils that are located within the four regions to develop what were the key things that needed to be identified. And that was defining food security, identifying the drivers or causes of food security, and to create a conceptual framework that showed us or helped us communicate how all of this is interlinked in order to do assessments. That advisory committee continuously engaged throughout 3.5 years to look at the information that was being gathered, help assess how the information was being gathered. The people that are on the advisory committee, I'm just going to list them, is Kayan Hartarik from the North Slope Arctic. Nicole Kaniarik was a youth advisor from that region, well, still is. From the Northwest Arctic is John Goodwin. Austin Swan and Percy Ballett. Denali Whiting is the youth representative. From the Bering Strait region is Julie Raymond Yacobian. She's a social scientist for the Kuwerik Inc. And the youth representative from there is Mallory Johnson. From the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, it's Tim Andrew, Vivian Corthris, Myron Nanning, and the youth representative is Suzanne Heckman from Pilot Station. So from that, they all continuously engaged. Now, moving forward, they'll continue to engage that we need to write technical papers in order to try to reach other audiences. And so collectively, we're all working together to draft those.
Within the ICC definition of food security, there is language that refers not only to physical need for sustenance from preferred wild foods, but also a reference to foods that are spiritually craved. Mm-hmm. That caught my eye. Tell us about the importance of this aspect of food security, the spiritual side of the connection to food.
I think that most people, and certainly the 145 contributing authors that made up this final report, say that food is in your heart. I mean, when we're talking about food, we're also talking about all those activities that surround it. So it's part of your spirit, it's part of your understanding, and it's part of what's been communicated from generations before that allowed for survival. That encompasses both physical and spiritual wellness. And so when there's a craving, the craving isn't just for the taste. It's not just your body saying, oh, I need some more iron now. It's also a craving. I'm sorry, I don't know completely how to explain this. It's something that you need to fulfill. That roots you back to your community. So, for example, we have a lot of Inuit that don't live in their villages anymore. So a lot of people live here in Anchorage. It's extremely important for them to have their foods. It keeps them connected to their environment and knowing how they belong within that environment. I think that all is part of what the spiritual craving is.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about food security and a changing climate and how that impacts people trying to get out and do the things that they've done for generations. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422. Carolina, I wanted to ask this next question of you, and then I'm hoping that Cyrus can also kind of chime in here, because I think this sort of the Manilik Traditional Foods Program probably speaks to this too. The idea of what food sovereignty is, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should say too that Cyrus is actually one of the 145 contributing authors, so he had quite a bit in deciding what this means. I think when we built the conceptual framework, it's built in the image of a drum, and it describes what characterizes food security, which is environmental health, and then these different dimensions that are needed to make up the environment, and then tools needed to support those. And that has to do with knowledge and policy and co-management. And when we have the spirit of all holding it together is like sinew. But the drum handle is the food sovereignty. That is a people's right to determine how, when, and where they're going to obtain their food and what type of food they're going to obtain. Without food sovereignty, there will not be food security, regardless of what you try to do. If you ship in a bunch of canned salmon, you're still not going to have food security. It has to come down back to that ability to process, obtain, and really based on decision-making power of what is going to occur surrounding the activities of food. And also, we actually know that this is true for every single culture. So even when we look at the entire state of Alaska or the entire country of the United States, there's a lack of food sovereignty because we're not producing our own foods. We're interdependent on multiple policies that interact with each other and sometimes are in conflict of each other of how to obtain that food. But also food sovereignty is going to speak to all of those, maintaining all of those other drivers of food security, such as language and education, in the way that a culture has determined necessary.
So it's fine to get a shipment of canned salmon when there's a shortage or a crisis. That's a fine thing for people to help each other out in communities. But really what you're saying is local control over over resources is critical for people to have that kind of stability and food sovereignty and security.
Yes, absolutely. I think we have to remember, too, without putting any judgment on anything being better than the other, is cultures have different value systems. That means how we decide things are going to be based differently. So it's really important that Inuit have the ability to use their value systems to determine how to engage. But again, that we're seeing food security not to be just nutrition or calories, it really has to include taking a young boy out to go caribou hunting for the very first time, and has to include that boy giving his first catch to an elder and becoming a provider. All of these things have to be thought of when looking at how are we going to address food security, but also how are we going to obtain food sovereignty.
Cyrus, I want you to chime in here now, too, about this idea of food sovereignty and local control, local autonomy in that regard, and how that is overlapped with state and federal regulations now. And then, Jim, you can also get into your role in this as a member of the state's Department of Fish and Game. But Cyrus, first talk about what food security is from your perspective and food sovereignty from the Manilik traditional foods perspective.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Carolina. You know, she explained it really well. And then speaking on my behalf as far as the experience of living outside or out in the country, rather, you know, when we're out harvesting, we harvest, you know, what there is a large amount of, whether it be fish or locations, or if it's caribou, small game, or whatnot. But growing up out in the country, that was our very first task, is to keep food stored, keep food put away. Certain times we could be working on Ugruk springtime, but what's set in mind is we're actually putting this food away for our winter use when times are hard to travel, hard to get around. And we don't see the adult Ugruk. The only time we see them is the month of June. So we do a lot of heavy hunting within that area.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what Carolina just explained, she did it really well. And I had more to say, but I kind of lose my notes here.
That's okay. Jim, do you want to jump in here too and talk about how you've worked over the last almost three decades to bring all the pieces together, the local knowledge, local control that was in place for generations before the state became a state and started to have overlapping regulations with the federal government. How have you worked to acknowledge all these different systems and help them to try to be in harmony with each other?
Well, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's primary responsibility is not to make regulations. We don't really do that at all. That's the purview of the Board of Game. They are seven members appointed by the governor, and they're the ones that create the regulations. In Fish and Game, our primary responsibility is to collect information, numbers, distribution, and provide that not only to Board of Game members, but also to the public, subsistence users, but it's really all publics. It's commercial operators, guides, transporters, it's non-local hunters who visit. Even non-residents have a stake in this. So I think the state of Alaska, going back almost to statehood, has one of the best systems out there in the United States for, you know, thinking about the big picture. All the public is involved. These advisory committees provide recommendations to the Board of Game what they want. And it's not just local advisory committees, it's even non-local advisory committees. The Anchorage Advisory Committee can comment on, you know, regulatory changes for the Western Arctic herd up here, but so can the Kotzebue Sound Advisory Committee. I think in the region where I work, Region 5, we've done an excellent job of not just being in our offices and insulating ourselves or isolating ourselves from the public. Every office, Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, and Barrow, we all have people that have lived in these communities for a long, long time. I'm not the only one. Geoff Carroll just retired from Barrow, but he was in Barrow as a biologist lost just as long as me. Down in Bethel, we've got two biologists. The grew up in Bethel, and they're working as fish and game biologists now. So I think they've done a really good job. We've all done a really good job of listening to the rural public. But in addition, we can't just listen to them. We have to listen to everybody.
All right. Well, thanks for that explanation. We are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we are going to continue our conversation about food security, what that means, and especially up against a changing climate. And we'd take your calls if you'd like to join our conversation as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing food security and the need to get out and do things in the wintertime and up against a changing climate that's making it more difficult for people to get out on the country sometimes and be able to hunt and fish and travel the way that folks did for generations. And now there's a challenge in the mix as the climate is changing and becoming harder to predict. To our friends in the Bethel region in southwest Alaska, the Alaska Dispatch News reported today that the Kuskokwim River is freezing up but isn't safe yet. The local search and rescue website says traveling over land is still the safest route. Give us a call if you're in the Bethel region and tell us about the conditions. Are you able to get out and hunt? Is the river ice forming late this year? Our numbers here are 1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. It was 36 degrees in Bethel yesterday, and it's about that right now in South Central. Cyrus, the program, the Hunter Support Agreement program that helps get food for elders, it sort of sounds like an Inupiaq Social Security program. Is that sort of the idea behind this, is just we're talking about food security and helping people stay where they want to be and eat the foods that they need, both physically and spiritually, as Carolina was talking about. Is this the idea behind this program, is just sort of a traditional Social Security program?
Well, I'm not too sure how to put it in words, but, you know, this program actually, I mentioned earlier how it really began, how it really got introduced up this way and designed as through the Title VI program, the federal-funded program. I mean, it's that the Title VI program is, you know, introduced nationally. Like I've mentioned, up this way when it got introduced to Manilak, which is nonprofit, we couldn't use those funds to go and buy the Western Diet type of meals to serve our elders. So that's where this program kind of got designed, for the Hunter Support Program. So it's similar, except it's just mainly feeding, you know, mainly helping our elders here, you know, with the foods that they prefer to have.
Sure. And how has that need changed over the years that you've been involved in the program? What is it greater? What can you tell us about how the need has changed?
How the hunting patterns?
Well, just the need for folks to access this hunter support program and be able to, both for from the hunter side, to get out there to be able to hunt and fish, but also from the elders' need side. Are you seeing, is the program growing, or how has the need changed in the years that you've been involved?
I didn't see too much changes, but once the funds get introduced to each tribe or each village, then they set the role on how they serve, you know, their particular village. under their own control. Like, for instance, Kotzebue being a big, the hub of this area.
Mm-hmm.
So the tribe there designed, you know, when hunters do come in, they have elders in mind that they're going out harvesting, or the elders, it would be by through elder request, you know, that the particular hunter within that family or relative area would go out for them. And for Kotzebue, there's only two hunting patterns. There's a fall hunt of caribou and a spring hunt of ugruk. And so it opens mostly within those two particular times. But for the villages, I couldn't really speak for the villages. They got their own timing for, you know, what they do. So it's their choice on how they make it work for their village. But of course, I get reports back, you know, from the tribes on as far as the justification, the funds that were used for this particular program, the number of elders provided, assisted with the amount of game.
Sure, sure. If you're just tuning in or you'd like to join our conversation, you could do so at 1-800-478-8255. We're talking about food security and a changing climate. 1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. 550-8422. I guess everyone's just listening today. Carolina, the kind of cultural concept that predates the Native corporation and nonprofit structure that's been in place for generations, does ICC help Indigenous communities with these types of programs? Is that assistance needed to help them stay robust in contemporary times, or do they sort of self-perpetuate in the same manner that this type of community assistance always has?
Well, for ICC's role, we deal with policy, and our job is focused on the international arena. So most of our work is done at the Arctic Council, and most people have heard of that right now because the United States has the chairmanship. So it's really to influence policy to maintain Inuit interest. Of course, we're there to assist in any way that we can, but it really is happening regionally. At the regional and local level is where the experts actually are. I think in listening to Cyrus, it makes me think this is something that's gone on forever, of people taking care of their community and providing food to widows and elders and those that aren't able to get. So I think it's a really, really fantastic example of providing subsidies in a culturally appropriate way and allowing for decision making to occur there. Earlier, when we talk about the importance of decision making, but then also talk about climate change. And Cyrus again mentioned how it's always important to go get what food you can. When thinking about climate change, you have to consider that, because all of a sudden the animal you used to depend on might not be there. But also how you process that animal is often weather dependent, whether you can dry it or other ways that you're going to prepare it. All of that has to be considered. And that requires very quick, adaptive decision-making. And so I think, going back to your original question, that it's only natural that locally and regionally those type of programs would be developed, because those are the people that are right there that have to make decisions on a daily basis.
So your work is more on the level of trying to impact policy and keep the folks that are making federal policy aware of what's happening in these communities, but you're sort of supporting the work that's being done in the communities through that effort and relying on those folks that are there day in and day out to let you know what's happening on a daily basis.
I think so, but I think that there's another scale, is that most of our work is done internationally, so it's how international policy is going to affect federal policy, because all of the people involved in federal policy are also involved in that arena as well. The other thing to remember is that all of our direction comes from the people at the villages through their regional organizations. So we're completely directed on how we're meant to approach it and when to approach it.
All right. Thank you so much for that. Let's go to the phones now. We have a caller in Sitka, and I'm so glad that Ron is joining us from Sitka, because I didn't want to leave Southeast Alaska out of this conversation. So I'm real happy that we've got somebody on. Hi, Ron.
Hey, I think this is a good time for me to air a pet peeve of mine. And that's the damage both culturally and economically that PETA, People for Ethical Treatment to Animals, and other groups have done, you know, to make fur go out of fashion. When I first got to Alaska Fairbanks in the late 60s, there were fur stores all over town, and they had beautiful tanned hides of lynx, wolf, and wolverine, and at hefty prices, you know. So you knew the trappers were making living. So trapping's just about unheard of these days in the villages, I'm afraid. But I think fur might be coming back. I'll end up on a happy note here. So that's my pet peeve.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in, Ron.
I have a question to ask
okay.
Jim, too.
All right.
Jim, I'm sorry about your house burning down, but isn't it wonderful the way the community reacts?
Jim?
Yeah, that was, it's just amazing, you know, the outpouring of support. Yeah, and so thank you for your comment, but it's just
okay.
been very humbling.
We in Sitka do the same thing. Okay. Oh, I want to ask you now, you caribou ruminate?
Yes, they do. They're a ruminant. They have five stomachs, the big rumen, and they're a ruminant. They ruminate.
All right. Well, I am really glad that Ron brought caribou into the conversation. Ron, it was like you were right on cue, because that's exactly where I want to go next. So, Jim, the Western Arctic caribou herd hit a peak of 490,000 in 2003. 2 years ago, 2013, the numbers had dropped to 235,000. What's going on there?
Yeah, the $60,000 question. I should do good at this one because I'm asked this, you know, probably several times a month. We think that what started the decline were these midwinter thaws and icing events. When those started happening back in the mid-2000s, 2005, 2006, we saw tremendous mortality rates among our adult cow caribou. It was the first time that I had measured a mortality rate that was almost 30%. That was unheard of. It used to be a 20% mortality rate. It was pretty high. I think that's what started things down, and I say that partly from the mortality rate, partly from looking at the caribou that did not die in those years. The ones that staggered out of winter were just in terrible condition, and that's what all the hunters around here were telling us, too. Boy, caribou were in tough shape this spring. But since that time, predator numbers have been going up. We've got lots and lots of brown bears, and both numbers have been going, you know, through the ceiling. And that's not based on data. I have to be absolutely forthright. We don't count those, either one of those species out here. At least, you know, bears, the Park Service has been counting in a few selected areas. But on wolves, we haven't done a wolf census out here since the early 90s. But you can't go to a village, or I can't go to a village, without getting lots and lots of input about lots of wolves and bears. So what I wanted to say is, although I don't think hunting started this, I don't think predators started the decline, I think it was weather-related. But since that time, now that we've got a lot fewer caribou than we had before and more predators, I think predators are having a much bigger force on numbers than they did, say, 15, 20, 25 years ago.
Well, let's continue on that theme with predators, only I want to ask you about the two-legged kind. An article in the 2006 Department Fish and Game Wildlife News, 9 years ago, examined the growing pressure on hunting in Game Unit 23, where you are. How has that increased? How many hunters and guides do you see from outside the Kotzebue area now? And how does that affect local hunters?
Well, the number of guides and their clients really has not increased for a long time. You hear that on the streets occasionally, oh, we're getting more hunters every year. But when you look at the data, the numbers of hunters has been about the same, and actually their harvests have declined. It's getting harder for those people to get caribou too, not just subsistence users, and heck, it's even affecting us in Fish and Game. We got all the collars deployed this fall, but the previous two falls we couldn't even get all our collars deployed on the Kobuk River. So again, I don't think hunting began the decline, but I think we're right at the cusp now, where hunting is going to be additive to this natural mortality, and hunting could start having an impact on how low the herd goes, how long it stays low, and how quickly it can recover. In terms of impacts of commercial operators and non-local hunters on local users, we really don't have any good data about camp location sites or takeoffs and landing sites to be able to definitively say, oh yeah, at this threshold of non-local hunters, you're not going to have any caribou, or you're going to have, you know, no local users there. But I think the one thing that I've seen unequivocally is that as caribou get tougher to come by for subsistence users, but also for these non-local users as well, sensitivities go up on both sides. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, some of the conflicts that have been out here in Unit 23 for a long time, long time, if this herd continues to decline, I see those only intensifying.
Mm-hmm. I have an email question for Cyrus now. I wanted to ask Cyrus a little bit about what he hears also from local hunters about the pressure from outside hunters on Unit 23. But here's a question from Nellie Moore, who is from Kotzebue. And she said, we recently enjoyed amazing video and photos of thousands of caribou and hundreds of seals right on and in Kotzebue Sound. Cyrus, was that an unusual event? Were people able to hunt either species?
Well, the caribou that you see across the ice there is what we call the coastal herd. And see, I grew up along the coast over in Sisolik, and that's the herd we normally harvest on, or, you know, put a supply away for the winter. So on that herd, like Jim have mentioned, you know, that kind of stayed behind and stayed put for a while, but they normally do that. They don't really start moving up until the part of the sound freeze to where they can make a crossing from the mouth of Notak to the Lockhart Point area. So they know what's ahead of them. They know the crossing that they have to deal with. So just as soon as we get enough ice, they did set trail. But with part of these leaders here, they made a little bit right turn following the lead over toward the south side of town to where, you know, they ended up on a dead end to where they had to turn back in and then go up toward on the north side of town. So that's where that photo was taken, and that's where the seals were all congregating within that lead with a big herring run or whatnot around the area. So that photo just so happened to be one out of a million. And so it happens, but this coastal herd or this coastal route, they normally wait on the cruise and stern Kivalina area up until it gets cold enough until they know it freezes within this area here. But as far as the sooner ones that were hunting on the Kobuk River, September, with outboard motors, boats, those ones crossed within that area. But the ones on the coast, they tend to stay put until it freezes.
All right. And were there hunting opportunities? That was part of the question, too. Were people able to hunt in this latest traveling through of caribou and seals?
Well, yeah, there were a fair amount of seal hunters going out there for seal, and there was more seal than, you know, most people ever saw. A lot of healthy population of Ugruk Chak, you know, which is the young bearded seal. And so these are the results that I see and what I hear from other hunters. That once these coastal caribou really started, they never really stopped. There were some hunters that did harvest some, but the ice conditions at the time, they were freshly new. There were no snow machines on the bay yet, so it was the caribou that really set the trail. So it is about it got cold about 26 below for a couple of days, so I took a snow machine right across and to Sisolik. We still had open water in front of town, but then I followed, you know, what were caribou tracks. You know, if they could make it, I figure I'd take my time and observe the trail and see areas where some did go through. So it, of course, it was 2 days of 26 below weather, so that froze over.
That helped.
Yeah, it really helped.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break again. I'm sorry to interrupt, Cyrus, but we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll return to this conversation about food security in a changing climate. And we'll go back to the phones as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations and communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're going to go back to the phones now. Mayo is in Palmer. Hi.
Hey there, how's it going?
It's going well. Did you have a question or a comment?
I did. I'm a teacher and student out in Palmer, and I'm really interested in putting traditional methods of obtaining food back in our schools to create food security for the next generation. I know this is being done in many places throughout Alaska, for example, trapping beavers in class, ice fishing, collecting berries, and making it part of the curriculum. So I have two questions. I'm curious if subsistence is being taught in schools up in Kotzebue, and also if just wondering how adaptation to climate change in regards to hunting and foraging is being taught to the youth.
So, Jim or Cyrus, do you want to respond to that question about what's being taught in schools?
Cyrus, you go first.
Yeah, well, it's been a while, but then we'd have what we call the Inupiaq Day, and then to where, you know, they'd get a selection of people out within the school system and have that one particular day just talk about, you know, different things, whether it be hunting, fishing, gathering, or whatnot, or anything that's got to do with subsistence. But I really didn't hear much of that lately, but these are some things that I'd participate in. But I haven't really heard or get a call on it for a while now. But then they do have those classes there, and I wouldn't really be the one to speak on it. And I kind of hope Mr. Woods, Raymond, that runs this program is listening and would call in.
Well, he better do it quick. Jim, from your perspective?
I was going to say the same thing. Raymond Woods has had an Inupiaq studies class for a long time. Raymond's born and raised in Shungnak to some amazing parents. Whole family's pretty neat. Anyway, he's been taking a bunch of students each spring on these long snow machine trips. They go to Selwick Hot Springs, they've gone down to Serpentine Hot Springs, not just once, they've done it, you know, for many years now. They've brought students up to the Fish and Game Caribou Collaring Project up at Onion Portage, and other schools have too. We've hosted up to two schools per year since the early 1990s, and often it's an Inupiaq Studies course that has brought students up there. And they've not just brought students up to talk with us, but oftentimes they'll bring an elder or two from their community, a man and a woman. And it's really neat when they do that. They get the science side from guys like me, you know, a beard and a flannel shirt. Then they get to hear the traditional side from the elders that are their neighbors. It's been really a neat program. But anyway, I think there's actually quite a bit going on out here in northwestern Alaska in that regard.
All right. Well, thanks, Mayo. I hope that helps you out.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I wanted to ask also about the health of the plants or the animals primarily that you are seeing in the Arctic. Are the caribou doing well, the ones that you are harvesting up there? Are they fat? Are they healthy? What's the health of the herd?
Cyrus, why don't you start, and then I'll follow you.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. Yeah, caribou being the main staple of meat, they've been really healthy this year. The first caribou that we started hunting, were, of course, were the bulls before they got in a rut, and each one of them had a good layer of fat on them. And then so is this coastal herd that did went by through there. We got a few of those, and each one of them had a good layer of fat on them. So a good sign, good healthy caribou. I was able to observe the very first portion of this coastal herd over at Sisolik. Of course, I didn't have time to be hunting any. I had a plane coming in. I had a meeting to go to, and so forth. So. Nice, looking healthy caribou.
All right. The health of the herd is good.
And I could add a little bit to that, too. That's all consistent with what we've seen from Fish and Game this year. We've been weighing calves now for about 6 or 8 years when we collar caribou onion portage. And the average weight for calves this fall in September was about 104, 105 pounds. That is huge compared to what we've usually seen. A lot of years the average weight for these calves is, in the high 80s, 80 pounds, 87, 88, 90 pounds. And, you get to look at thousands of caribou up close and personal, and we saw no skinny caribou this fall at all. And over the last probably 5 to 6 years, the proportion of caribou that we've handled, we've had a lower and lower proportion that we've attributed to sub-average body condition. So,
well, that's good.
We've seen nothing in our health assessments or reports from the hunters or our personal observations that this herd is being food limited at all. There's no evidence of that whatsoever.
All right, and we only have a minute left. Carolina, I wanted to give you a chance at a final statement here. Are there benefits to a warming Arctic? Are there things in this change that could actually be good for people in the Arctic?
I think that really depends on who you ask. So I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. I think there's pros and cons to everything. In the work that ICC has done with these 145 contributing authors really emphasizes that it does not have to do with a single component, that the trade-offs do not have to do with a single component. So it's not just climate change. It's climate change in combination with other drivers such as user conflict and climate change is going to cause a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. This hour always flies by fast. Thank you so much to my guests. Carolina Behe with ICC is in the studio. Jim Dow, AF Department of Fish and Game caribou biologist, on the phone from Kotzebue, and Cyrus Harris of the Manilik Traditional Foods Program. Thanks to our engineer, Monica Goki, and Josh Edge on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. Thank you for listening today.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.